Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd here, about to be joined by Thomas Drance. We are live from the Kintech studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. The Bridge Street Dunbar Lumber and Ladder has moved to Progress Way in Tilbury's Industrial Park. More room, more product, more awesome. Details at dunbarlumber.com. It's Drance's first remote show of the season, which means it's time for the most exciting part of my job, when I throw to Drance on the road for the first time, and I cross my fingers to hope that the connection holds up. Drancer, what's going on?
Buddy, I have
hopes. Nailed it.
Hopes. I really believe that we're figuring it out, making progress, going to have a good, clear feed and a good, clean show.
This sounds the best it's ever sounded. This is great.
Look at that. Look at that. Innovation in the radio space.
Wow. The telecommunications company is figuring it out.
Sportsnet 650. And thank you, too, to the Chicago Blackhawks for setting me up in a nice little auxiliary suite. I expected that I'd have to miss auxiliary suite, an auxiliary locker room space. It's a dressing room. I was expecting that I'd have to catch a cab back downtown before joining you. I was able to get set up right next to, well, the coach's office, actually.
Perfect.
So apologies to Rick Tockett and their staff for having to hear me speak loudly and in animated fashion about their work directly. If I'm not as critical as I usually might be, now you know why. So able to join you for this batch interview, which is very exciting for me. You know, I don't like to miss batch.
No, of course. I was going to have to think of some harebrained game to get batch to play. But all right. Without further ado, now joining us, he is the voice of the Canucks here on Sportsnet 650, our guy, Brendan Batchelor. What's going on, Batch?
I thought I dodged a bullet and wasn't going to have to play some silly game.
Well, we'll see.
Drance is ready to go just in time.
Yeah, it's more difficult when Drance is on the road. So you might have dodged the bullet anyways. I think it's harder to pull off when we're in different places. So we'll see. It might just be a normal conversation, but I guess I can't speak to what Drance has planned here. But all right, the Canucks have their first couple of wins of the season, of course, first in overtime against the Panthers, then over the weekend, 3-0 against the Flyers. And I think fair to say, you know, neither game Rick Tockett is going to be pointing to as a perfect example of how he wants his team to be playing throughout the season. But what kind of improvements have you seen from the team over those first couple of victories?
Yeah, I think the Philadelphia game is the one worth talking about the most, just because they locked down a lead, which is something that they struggled with right off the hop to start the year. And like the best compliment I can give them is I thought that third period was pretty boring. Mm. But when you've got a 3-0 lead and you're trying to lock things down, I think they did a really good job of that. Now, you know, finding a fine line between being a team that tries to sit back on a lead all the time and, you know, still playing your style is going to be something they have to work through, because we all know that sitting back on leads doesn't necessarily work all of the time. But I thought they did a good job of, like, still controlling the puck in the offensive zone. That third line with Bluger, Sherwood, and Heinen in particular, I thought were really effective throughout the game. And they kind of sort of, you know, squeezed the life out of the Flyers, who didn't really have much of a push late in that game. So that's a big step in the right direction when you contrast it to the 4-1 lead given up in the season opener against the Flames. And I think something we're going to be talking about a lot going forward this season, not just in the short term, but over the longer term this year as well, is how do they find that balance between being more aggressive offensively and creating more off the rush like they've talked about, while still playing that lockdown style that I think we saw them do such a good job of in the third period against Philly in particular.
Yeah, and against Philly, you know, you didn't necessarily see them attack a lot, but they also didn't have to, right? Because they were up 3-0. And as you said, it's a fine line where you don't want to get too comfortable sitting back like that. But it did feel like, as much as they were sloppy first, you know, certain stretches of the back half of that game, if Philly had broken through and scored a goal or two, I feel like you would have seen the Canucks kick it up to a higher gear, but they were just never really pushed to do so by the Flyers in that game.
Yeah. Well, and you don't want to be in a situation where you have to push it into a higher gear again after gearing down, because I think that's something that's really difficult to do in sports in general, let alone in hockey. Or, you know, how many times do we see, like, you know, the first game of the season's a perfect example where, you know, obviously Miller gets the tying goal right at the end there to force overtime, but they were never really able to find that same gear from the first period again after sort of, you know, putting things on the back burner a bit. So, you know, I think Kevin Lankinen has to be given a lot of credit for holding them in there in certain sequences in that game. And, you know, it's the first time really that they've been able to build a lead and hold on to it comfortably. So that's a thing to build off of and a good stride in the right direction. But, yeah, you know, we'll learn more about them when they face adversity in those situations. Like, what if they do give up the 3-1 goal or the 3-2 goal? Are they still able to execute in the way they want to see it across the finish line or not?
The thing that looks so different for me in Philadelphia, even relative to the win in Florida, Batch, was that the very least – the club had depth contributors that kind of worked, including that Bluger line that I think did a pretty good job of making it dull in a good way in that game against Philadelphia. What did you see from Bluger, Heinen, Sherwood in that game?
Yeah, I think it's like the ideal Rick Tocchet bottom six performance from those guys. Like, they got in on the forecheck, they won battles, they were physical, they held on to pucks. You know, they at times hemmed the Flyers in, and it wasn't necessarily that they were creating grade A chances, but when you've got a lead, time spent in the offensive zone is king, because, you know, teams aren't able to come back the other way and create against you. And, they clearly make it hard on their opponents. Sherwood in particular, you could see him getting under the skin of the Flyers, and it speaks to, you know, the reason they acquired him and what Quinn Hughes had to say about him and the way he played in the Nashville series last year. So, you know, it's kind of reminiscent. And again, like, Joshua and Garland had more offensive upside, I think, than that line probably does. Although maybe I'm wrong. We'll see how things play out, assuming they stay together going forward. But it's like a third line from last year light, where they play the game the way that Tocchet wants them to play it. They execute it very well. They spent a lot of time in the offensive zone, at least, you know, I haven't looked at the numbers, but at least from the eye test, it felt that way. And they make other teams earn anything they're going to get against them. And, you know, if they can continue to do that, then I kind of like the way that the lines are deployed right now, because even though you've somewhat stacked your top six with all of the guys that you think should be playing there right now, you're not giving anything up or not giving as much up in the bottom six as you might in other situations, if that line can continue to execute the way they did on Saturday.
Is there a chance in your view that Erik Brännström is a thing?
Yeah, I think there's a chance he's a thing. You know, we need to see more of a sample size to really believe it, just because, you know, in terms of being consistent in the way that they would like him to be at the NHL level, it maybe hasn't been there for him. And, you know, anytime a team doesn't qualify a guy that was a big trade piece for them in acquiring, you have to ask questions about why that might be. And then Colorado was willing to deal him away just, you know, what, like 6 weeks after signing him or whatever it was. So, you know, I still have lots of questions there. But that said, what did we talk about all summer? Lack of puck-moving ability on the bottom two defensive pairings. And what does he bring? He brings an ability to move the puck. Now, you know, is he going to be able to defend in a way that Rick Tocchet is willing to accept, to a level where he can be in the lineup every night and can have an impact? That remains to be seen. I think it's kind of a similar conversation to Daniel Sprong in the forward group in terms of, like, you know what he's going to bring in on the offensive side of the puck, but what about the two-way game? I think you could probably say the same thing of Brännström in the longer term. But in the shorter term, you know, I thought he was quiet against Florida, which is what you want from a guy that you're just airdropping into the lineup when he's never practiced with his new teammates. And then I thought he had some good plays and was more of a positive factor against the Flyers. And I think him and Desharnais seemed to have a little bit of chemistry and played well together. So, you know, I don't want to get ahead of myself, because we see all the time that, you know, guys will come up and have a few games and the conversations are, oh, is he going to be a thing? And have they found the solution? And then 3 games later, he's back in Abbotsford and it wasn't the solution. But he has a chance. He's just got to continue to execute at a consistent level the way he has through his first two games as a Canuck.
Okay, Batch, so it's the part of the conversation where we have to talk about Elias Pettersson, of course, the number one topic of conversation through this young Canucks season. And I think it's undeniable over the last couple of games, signs of progress from Elias Pettersson, right? The trajectory is on the right track, at least. How significant would you say that the progress has been over those last couple of games for Elias Pettersson?
I would say it's one or two or maybe a step in the right direction, but I'm not going to sit here and say that, like, he's back to where he needs to be yet. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he was moving his feet more against the Flyers. He was more involved, I thought. Obviously, the play to set up Hoglander was great. He had a couple other good moments. And I think anytime, you know, this is not specific to Pettersson, because obviously we microanalyze him and his game all the time, but with any player in a slump, you're looking for signs of life. So are they on the puck? Are there chances you can think back to that they were involved in, either as the guy that was getting the chance or the guy that was setting up the chance? And I think Elias Pettersson clears that bar coming off the Philadelphia game. But, you know, obviously the bar for him needs to be a lot higher in terms of someone that, you know, can dictate the way the game is played at times and, you know, can control the game and can, you know, make plays that not a lot of other guys on that ice are capable of making. We're not there yet. But you can't run a mile before you take the first step. So I think he's taken the first couple of steps, and that's a positive sign. But it's not like he's off the hook yet or anything in terms of getting to the level that this team needs to get him to in order for them to, you know, achieve some of the things as a group that they want. He needs to be a lot better than he's been through the first handful of games here to start the year.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that, right? And I said earlier in the show that, like, you'd love to see him have a real signature type game pretty soon. You know what I mean? Where it's the points on the board, but also just the shift by shift dominance that we've seen from Elias Pettersson in the past. And, you know, I did think one thing that stood out to me is, again, obviously we want to see that production, right? And fans want to see that production. And as you said, he was more involved in scoring chances, creating scoring chances, but I thought he was also more involved carrying the puck through the neutral zone on Saturday. And That's a huge part of his game, right? You go, like, he's really, really good at helping the team get from the defensive zone to the offensive zone. That's one of the things that's made him a superstar, and if he's going to live up to the contract, the points have to be there, but the impact all over the ice and transitioning the puck has to be there too.
Yeah, and he looked less tentative, I think, which is, like, the biggest step in the right direction in that regard. Is, like, we can all think of, like, signature Pettersson goals or shifts or plays, and this is a guy that is as confident as they come when he's playing well, that isn't second-guessing or being tentative or anything like that, that he's just taking over the game, and he's got the puck, and he's going to do whatever he has to do with it, whether that's skating it through the neutral zone or creating a play in the offensive end or even getting a zone exit in his own zone, right? Like, I think when he's moving his feet and has the puck, he's good at doing things like that too. So that's encouraging to me, but again, like, he looked less tentative, but he wasn't full-on, like, dominant Pettersson, like, I'm going to take this puck and I'm going to do what I want with it and you got to try and stop me. Like, he's not there yet. So, again, step in the right direction, like, all the things I said previously about it, I think applies, but that's the most encouraging thing. Is, I don't know, you know, even thinking back to the stretch run last year and into the playoffs and then to the start of this year, I don't know if I've seen him as deliberate in terms of making plays and carrying the puck and his skating as he was on Saturday against Philadelphia. So that's a positive sign, and now he's got to try and gain some confidence from that and build on it to get back to being that, like, confident player that has a swagger about him, right? Like, when Pettersson's playing well, he's got a swagger about him, and that's why right now.
Batch, I think it's tempting, and I think it's common in our market right now when we talk about Pettersson to factor what we've seen this season into the troubling stretch run and playoff performance that we got from him last year. But to my eyes, it does look different. Where do you land on this?
It looks different.
We're going to drop Batch. We'll maybe try to reconnect with Batch here. Oh,
I was sure it was me, Jamie.
No, I think it's Batch. It's hard to tell. Who knows? We made a compromise. We got great audio from you, and then we completely torched it on Batch's phone connection. But we'll try to get Brendan Batchelor back on the line here for the remainder of the conversation. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Okay, we have Batch, but he wants you to restate the question. So I don't think he caught it properly, Jantz.
Yeah, no, I just think that there are chances happening. I think he is more inside in this first five games, even if the production hasn't jumped off the page, than he was down the stretch and in the playoffs last year. So I see it sort of as like two different things, but I know everyone's connecting it as like one large streak with a tough problem involved.
Yeah, no, I agree too. I think he's like the signs of life that are there right now were not there last year. And whether that was because of the tendonitis he was dealing with or whatever, you know, who knows? That's in the past. That doesn't really matter, right? It's all about how he executes now. So I agree. He's more involved. He's more on the inside. He's trending in the right direction. But at the same time, like when you have stats, like the guy hasn't scored an even strength goal in 31 games, I think it's natural to connect the two. And, you know, there is an off season in between them. But until he gets back to not just the way that he can play, but the level that he can produce at, right? Like, even though there have been positive signs, what's it, 2 points now in five games, 2 assists, if I'm not mistaken, off the top of my head. So, like, I think the bottom line production needs to come back for him to quiet those doubters that are going to try and connect last season's performance with this season's performance, because ultimately with the contract that he's on right now and the expectations around him and the level that he produced at pre-All-Star break last season, until he starts putting the puck in the back of the net and gets to the level where he's a point-a-game guy, then those questions are still going to be asked, and to a certain extent, I think rightfully so.
Batch, I took a run at asking him where he thought his game was at in the early going this season at practice today. How do you think that went?
How'd that go? probably not well, would be my guess.
That's a good guess.
So we won't be playing that clip later, is what you're saying, Dranser?
No. But you can read about it later at The Athletic, and we can talk about it tomorrow. But yeah, I would say not particularly eager to talk about matters of confidence and working through cold streaks at the moment.
Yeah, well, I mean, I color me the opposite of shock. Let's put it that way.
It would have been a big scoop for you, Dreds, if you'd really gotten him to open up on that one. It would have been incredible. Paid for the price of going on the road just in that answer if you had got it. Okay, Batch, just before we let you go here, I did want to ask you as well about the power play. I think it's fair to say it's underwhelmed through the first five games, and then we talk so much about what they do in zone, but they've had problems gaining the zone, getting set up. What's standing out to you when you watch the Canucks power play right now?
Yeah, it's the same thing that you said. Like zone entries, I think, were a big issue for them down the stretch last year, and they still appear to be to a certain extent. How much of that is down to confidence or down to just early season? They're still trying to work through things, or whether some of the, bad mojo from last year has carried over to this year. The one thing I will say, though, is they have had sequences where they've had some really good looks, and I think they're starting to do more of what Tocchet is asking about, where they're just attacking rather than trying to find a set play all the time. And, there's been talk, too, about, like, they find a set play, they get an opening for themselves, and then they just go into another set play rather than attacking. I think we've seen a little bit more of that attacking mentality. It just hasn't, borne any fruit as of yet. So much like we talk about Pedersen's individual game, I think for those guys, to see a couple pucks go in the back of the net would make a big difference for them in terms of their confidence, in terms of buying into what the coaching staff is asking them to do. But this is one of the many things that they're going to have to deal with this year, and it's not just a power play thing, but it's an overall team thing. When you have some success as a team, there's more of a book out there on you, and teams are going to game plan against you more in a more detailed way and be more prepared for what kind of looks you're going to show them. So you need to find a way to create different looks or to find a way to overcome the way teams are going to defend you in spite of that. And that's going to be a challenge for this team, you know, at even strength, I think, at times. It's going to be a challenge for them, certainly on the power play, and it's a challenge that they still look like they're working through to me. So I'm not at the point where I want to freak out or panic about the power play yet, but there's certainly some room for improvement there that we'll need to see from them in the coming games, to say the least.
Batch, appreciate it, man. Thanks for doing this. We'll talk soon.
Hey, we didn't play any goofy games.
We did not play any goofy games. See, I told you, it's too touch and go with the technical side of things. We can't risk it. Can't risk it on remote shows. Okay, but next time we'll do it.
I was going to say, I'll look forward to a draft or a weird ranking or something.
Absolutely.
Tears. Tears, baby.
And the game it'll have to be extra goofy to make up for missing this one. So we'll really get in the lab and cook something up for you.
Much like Elias Pettersson waiting to be asked about his game by Thomas Drance, I cannot wait.
Thank you, Batch.
Thanks, guys.
That is Brendan Batchelor, voice of the Canucks here on Sportsnet 650, joining us and weighing in on the Canucks coming off that win in Philly. Drance, I mean, you and I have barely had a chance to chat here. Obviously, you joined the show just before we got Batch on the line. Just a few minutes left here, and I think we can kind of dig into what you saw at practice and look ahead a little bit in the next segment, in the final hour of the show coming up. But, I mean, I know you touched on it just quickly with Batch there. What was your kind of big takeaway from the win against the Flyers for the Canucks?
I mean, I don't think it was a great performance by any means, but I thought it was in some ways reassuring to see the team win and play pretty well overall, like win relatively easily, given that I didn't feel like it was all on their best players, right? Like, even that win in Florida, which, you know, had elements that were not as good as the game in Philadelphia, but also elements that I think were better, you know, especially from, like, a overall team intensity perspective. You know, it felt like a lot of it was on the fact that on that night, especially with Barkov and Tkachuk on ice, the Canucks had the best player. The Canucks brought the best player to the game in Quinn Hughes. Quinn Hughes picked his teeth with the Florida Panthers, despite the struggles of the rest of the team. And then ultimately they got a great individual effort from JT Miller to seal the win. This Philadelphia game, it was like that Bluger line I thought was excellent. Rick Tocchet today noted that they helped stem the tide when Philadelphia was sort of beginning to stack some heavy shifts by just having like a quiet, no-nonsense heavy shift in the offensive zone that he felt was important within the flow of that game. I thought the Brännström-Deharnay pairing, you know, utilized pretty sparingly against Florida, was able to play more and played really well. Even the Susie Myers pairing, I think, had their best game of the season. And so all of a sudden, the Canucks like outshot the Flyers even when Quinn Hughes wasn't on the ice. And for me, that's a really important thing for this team to get because, you know, going into that game, they'd been outshot 33-60 in minutes that Quinn Hughes wasn't playing at 5-on-5. Like, you know, if that persists or is a trend all season long, there's no way this team is winning 50 games and getting to 109 points and contending to win the division. Like, that's, I don't care who your goaltender is. I don't care how good you are at finishing. Like, that's too many minutes where you're losing shifts for any team to overcome, no matter how good you are at the top end. Like, we're seeing that in Colorado right now, right? Like, it doesn't even matter if your top end is the best in the league, if you're getting sort of outshot to that extent. So I was glad to see that trend reverse. I think the thing I'd say, though, is I still don't think we've seen this team play an identity game, right? Like, I still don't know exactly what it's going to look like when this team is fully rolling yet. And that's okay. By the way, we didn't see that until game 6 last season. I always talk about that Nashville game. That was game 6. So it's like we didn't see that through five games last year either, even though the team was coming off of like a nice win in Florida, you know, at the same point in the season. So not a criticism, just I think this team's still finding it. I think they're still finding those identity games, finding their A game, or even finding their sustainable B game that they can maintain through the season. I don't think we have a real sense yet of what that's going to look like. And so I didn't think that Philly was like a template win or something that I'm going to likely look back on in the big picture. I just thought it was like a good performance in which Vancouver's depth players showed up and played really well, something that I really needed to see from this team, given how concerning that those sort of non-Hughes minutes had looked going into Game 5 of the regular season.
All right, the Canucks practiced in Chicago today. Of course, they take on the Blackhawks tomorrow. That's their final game of the road trip. Drancer was there, so we'll get some of his impressions from practice. Look ahead to that Chicago game. Some updates in terms of health as well from practice today. We can take some of your questions as well. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Send your thoughts in, and we'll be back with more Canucks talk here on Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Vic Nizar. Have your say and join me on The People's Show with big takes and even bigger bets weekdays 3 to 4 on Sportsnet 650 or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance with you. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Let Kubota do your heavy lifting. Visit them online at DLEAMC.com. We are live from the Kintech studio. Kintech, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Drancer on the road covering the team in Chicago where they practice today. Of course, they're taking on the Blackhawks tomorrow. And some interesting notes out of practice, Drancer. And I think, you know, one situation that was on the radar for a lot of Canucks fans is the health of JT Miller and his status. Of course, kind of a strange situation against Philly, right? Leaves right after the opening draw, appears to hurt himself, comes back, plays pretty normal minutes, but doesn't take faceoffs after that. And I understand they were calling it a maintenance day for Miller's absence at practice in Chicago today.
Yeah, they were. And Rick Tocchet, you know, stopped short of describing Miller as questionable for tomorrow, but did say, you know, the next 24 hours will be important. I sort of followed up and, you know, the fact that Miller's usage had changed so dramatically after he returned from whatever it was that ailed him against the Philadelphia Flyers on Saturday, but didn't take draws, right? Gave me an opportunity to sort of follow up. So I said, will he take draws if he's in? And again, you know, sort of, we'll see tomorrow. We've got 24 hours was kind of the talking point. So look, JT Miller doesn't miss games, right?
Yeah.
Like, guys missed seven games in his Canucks tenure, and three of them were when he was like an asymptomatic COVID positive. Right. Like and another one was when they elected to sit him before the playoffs last year.
Yeah.
So it's realistically, this guy's missed three games where he sort of actually couldn't go for whatever reason in what's it been now? Five. This is sixth season.
Yep.
I mean, to play the way he plays and to be available at that level of consistency means you're pretty comfortable playing at less than 100%. Right, like it says a lot about his pain tolerance and overall toughness, in addition to a lot of other, you know, things about him. So, I would expect him to be in. That said, you know, I don't know that the club necessarily deployed like pure placeholder practice lines. Right, like you bump Suter up to the top line to take line rushes at 5-on-5 with, in between DeBrusk and Brock Besser. I mean, that does feel to some extent like preparing for what your lineup may have to look like. Now, Baines at the net front on PP1, I suppose you could say that that's a placeholder.
Yeah.
But even then, why not have him act as the placeholder on the half wall where Miller usually plays? Like, does that speak to a wider change that the does the club want Garland and Pettersson at the flanks now? Is that a more meaningful change that we should read into? DeBrusk dropping down to the second unit? Like, is that something meaningful, or is that is Bane serving as a Miller placeholder? That I don't know. What I'd say is it's a little cloudier than simply one of those practice lines where it's like, and he's a placeholder, which gives us confidence that Miller is a lock to play. I expect Miller to play, but I do think the club practiced in a way that makes me less than 100% confident that that won't be a story when I show up at the rink for skate tomorrow.
Yeah, like if Neil Zaman was in the top line spot and Miller's spot on the power play, right, and nothing else changed, you'd say, okay, that's just pure placeholder, that he's keeping his spot warm for JT Miller, and Miller is going to play. As you said, I think Suter being there, it could still easily be that, but maybe it changes the calculation at least a little bit. Maybe the team just kind of covering their bases a little bit in case Miller isn't ready to go tomorrow. The power play change is interesting, right? Because there's two new bodies on it in Garland and Baines, and then Miller, who was absent, is off of it, and then DeBrusk moves down to the second power play unit. So that one, it can't just be a pure placeholder situation, right? Because they didn't just make one change, they made the two changes. And, you know, we were having the conversation with Batch. It's obvious that the power play has not found its groove, found its rhythm yet. So I think it is fair to read more into those changes. Now, I do wonder if they had Miller healthy, would he be the net front guy? But Garland in that normal JT Miller spot, like, I would wager that is a change they want to make even beyond just not having Miller available. But that's maybe something they want to see, at least trying a different look on that power play, which hasn't really got going yet.
Yeah, and look, I think you know how I rate Garland and how I rate his game.
Mm-hmm.
But I like him down low or in the middle a little bit more than I like him as a puck handler up high, just because I think the sort of Pettersson, Miller, Hughes axis, it's been pretty effective. They've had continuity. They've had years to work together. That's an edge. Like, in a hard cap league, you don't always get that sort of continuity in an area of the game where chemistry and nuance and sort of thoughtful teamwork, geometry, can sort of work together to make you more imposing. Like, I don't know how much of the rest of the league you've watched in the early going here, Jamie, but like the New York Rangers power play, right?
Yeah.
The New York Rangers power play is going to be the best in the league this season, period. Especially because the Tampa Bay Lightning need a right-handed shot here. But we used to see it with Kucherov, Hedman, Stamkos up top. Obviously, they've sort of sustained a higher level of consistency than the Canucks have with Miller, Pettersson, and Hughes. But, you know, there's something to the ability to keep a core group together, figuring it out as a collective, that I do think allows advantages to accrue to skilled teams, especially in 5-on-4 attacking situations. And you're seeing it with New York. Like, that power play is absolutely on fuego to start the year. It's the most fun thing to watch in hockey. They're going to be the best in the league by season's end. And I think part of it is that it's the same five-man unit. Like, it's almost one of those stories. Like, if you were to recap sort of like things you've noticed around the league this year, no one would bring that up because it's almost like old hat. Like,
yeah,
oh yeah, the New York Rangers have a good power play. Yeah. Wow. Like, I didn't know that. You know, like, people would say that, but it's like, no, we should actually appreciate it. We should appreciate when teams are special and do special things and maintain that year over year, and in fact get better simply because they're all smart and skilled and awesome at it. The Canucks power play should have an opportunity to do that. Like, as much as other teams have the advantage of like, hey, these are their tendencies. We've seen this power play before. They've had success doing this. We can stop it. You know, you also have a group that's been together and knows each other really well, scheming against that, scheming to build answers within their game. So, I mean, I do think that's an edge that goes or should go both ways. I like Miller up high because, I think he's driven a lot of Vancouver's power play success over the years. I do, however, think that if you want to more significantly dynamite what this group's mentality is 5-on-4, the only way to do it is to move Miller. right? Like, the only way to do it is to move Miller, because it's so discombobulating to how this power play has functioned, that maybe it gets some of that more movement, some of that more attacking mindset stuff that I know Tocchet's wanted to focus on, or wanted this group focused on, to be like a necessity. You can't fall back on Miller dissects defense, right? So I could see it as sort of a change, but my sort of first reaction is that if Daniel Sprong can just be a little bit more consistent, and if you could add his shot to the flank, that's really what I'd like to see from PP1. As good as I think Garland is just like a string puller and playmaker and intelligent all-around attacking player, Sprong's shot is so unique that I'd love to see that weapon utilized with Vancouver's skill players and in space.
Yeah, I think that point about shaking things up by moving Miller specifically is a really good one, right? Because he's so talented with the puck on his stick, and he's made so much happen from that spot that it must be just really easy psychologically for the players, right, to say, hey, it's never a bad idea to get it to Miller on the flank. And that's true, but then you also end up being pretty predictable, right? And you take away that element of just attacking and attack and that attacking mentality that Tocchet is trying to instill. It's almost like taking the security blanket away, right? Okay, you're not going to be able to rely on that. You have to figure out something else. Now, it's a very fine line to walk, because you are taking a really extraordinarily talented player out of a position where they've done really, really good things. Having said that, like, JT Miller's such a good player, he can be great at the net front too, right? He can be good at a bunch of different spots on the power play, and if you have to kind of give them that shock in the early going here and hope that it pays dividends in the long runs, well, fair enough, and I can understand the logic there, but it's also the kind of thing where if it doesn't produce immediate results, it strikes me as something that's hard to stick to. You know what I mean? Because even for the 100%. Coaches, it's like, oh man, we thought this would work, but yeah, we better just go back to JT Miller where he's used to, you know?
Well, and I think also the you know, idea that DeBrusk off of PP1 five games in sort of cements something I talked about a lot in the lead up to the season, right? Which was that the bumper skill set, the Horvat skill set that this team was looking to find, it wasn't a lock that he was going to be able to fit into doing that, right? And I actually think he's played really well, right? I know he hasn't had his first goal yet, but there have been a lot of good setups, a lot of quality hockey that he's played. I think, like, I wouldn't put DeBrusk on a list of disappointments or anything, given how his first five games have gone. He's been productive. He hasn't had a break in terms of the goal scoring side yet, but I think you've seen the north-south attacking dynamism that he'll bring to this lineup. But that working in space, bumper spot, finisher role is nuanced, is different. If this is sort of not the end of the experiment, but a pause on that experiment, I don't think it's an indictment in any way of how DeBrusk has played, but I do think it reinforces just how difficult it is to sort of fit in that role, in that sort of like primary weapon role. And a guy like Besser, right? I mean, we've seen him have success all over the formation with this group. We know that he knows sort of where the passes are coming from, how Hughes and Miller are going to operate at the flanks how Pettersson's going to operate from the flanks and how Hughes is going to operate at the blue line. He's got that sort of anticipation, that built-in familiarity, which I think matters a ton in this phase of the game. So, it's tough. But again, this really does emphasize for me also the importance of finding that fourth forward. Right? Like that's going to be something that this team is going to need, I think, to be an elite power play group. Last year, with the first full season without Horvat, I think the leading scorer who was on the roster at the end of the season, outside of, Hughes, Besser, well, Hughes isn't a forward, so Besser, Pettersson, Miller on the power play, had 5 points, right? It was Connor Garland.
Yep.
Lindholm was the leading goal scorer in the playoffs with 2, right? Like, finding that fourth forward to contribute on PP1 has, I think, been a sort of continual search ever since the Horvat and then the Kuzmenko trades, right? Like, really since the Horvat trade, but especially after the Kuzmenko trade, I think it sort of you know, was in flux. We saw Pugh Suter play a bit there. We saw Connor Garland play a bit there. We saw Elias Lindholm play a bit there. And none of them, like all of them had moments of success, but none of them really took the reins and made that spot their own. You know, for me anyway, like maybe Garland can have this breakthrough, right? Like I'm not going to be shocked at all if Garland can figure it out, right? This is an enormously talented player, a player who I think is far better than even the market thinks, and I think the market's done a 180 on his value. But that said, you know, I feel a lot stronger about Garland's elite impact at 5-on-5 than I do about his ability to be like a key distributor, high-end flanker on the power play. You know, for me anyway, by far the highest upside option that remains on this roster is Daniel Sprong, and yet you kind of can't be in that spot if you're not going to be a fixture in the lineup.
Right.
And I don't know that Sprong has done enough to you know, sort of answer that question for Rick Tocchet, right, with the sort of confidence required to earn that role. So that's sort of the tension or dynamic that I'm going to be monitoring as it unfolds here.
One of the other health situations that, you know, on the radar for the Canucks and three-putt Shane Texan, any Dakota Joshua updates? And he was skating with the group again, I believe, but in a non-contact jersey, correct?
Yeah, so he's now gotten two full skates with the group in a non-contact jersey. You know, this is a very different type of injury than what we usually talk about. Like, you know me, Jamie, I usually do the week to 10 days, right, from when a guy rejoins the group in a non-contact or limited capacity. I tend to think week to 10 days. But of course, Dakota Joshua, who was diagnosed over the summer with testicular cancer and had surgery, you know, to sort of set that right and has been recovering from it. I mean, there are unique considerations there. Obviously, from a you know, not just a return to play perspective, but a return to performance perspective, and of course health considerations, which go above and beyond that. You know, of like a tweak, right, or a hamstring pull,
yep,
or whatever. Pick whatever lower body injury you want. So, you know, I don't know that timeline necessarily applies, but it could. And the fact that he's been able to skate with the full group, be a full participant, switch in on line rushes, like there's no, he's in a non-contact jersey, but he's a full participant functionally in these practices. This is a full, like there's no drill that he's on the side for. Although toward the end of the practice, he was skating lines while some of his teammates did some other work. But that was the only distinction between him and a normal participant functionally at practice today. That suggests to me, you know, not strongly, but at least suggests to me somewhat that you know, his return might be in that week to 10 days from Saturday sort of range away. But again, unique considerations, hard situation to handicap. That's just what I'm seeing and observing and sort of how I'm thinking about it at this juncture.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, that could put him potentially in line to play on the homestand coming up, right? They obviously after Chicago, then they don't play again till Saturday. Then they play Tuesday and Thursday as well. So, I mean, that would be great news for Dakota Joshua, obviously just on an individual level, but you have to imagine that would be a big boost for the team as well, right? To get Dakota Joshua back on the ice with them in a game would be, that'll be a special moment when it happens.
Yeah, and I think there's, you know, real value, obviously, that a player of Dakota Joshua's quality provides. Like, this is not, this is a guy who was on pace to score 20 goals last season, right? Who has a unique profile relative to everyone else on this team, who would have been one of the more highly sought after unrestricted free agents if he'd made it to market, but likes it in Vancouver so much that the Canucks were able to get, you know, something of a sweetheart deal, you know, in retaining him. I think there have been moments, not a ton of moments, because certainly the Canucks were able to do things like, you know, match the desperation and grind out a bruiser of a game against the Florida Panthers, you know, just last week. So, you know, not that it's been decisive or fatal or a significant flaw that's been exposed. I'm not trying to be that dramatic, but there have been moments through the club's first five games where I do think the lack of size on the forward in the forward group has been noticed, notable. And in, you know, Joshua returning, I think that's, you know, not a flaw that almost entirely goes away, right? Like Joshua, I think, makes this forward group far more imposing, far more difficult along the wall. His defensive value shouldn't be questioned. You know, his penalty killing, I think, is useful. And I'm sure once he's up to full speed, he'll be one of their foremost used penalty killing forwards. He certainly should be. He'll make their forecheck way more robust. I mean, he's probably the most disruptive F1 that this team has, especially now that Miller plays at center. And, you know, I still want to see more net front Joshua, right? Club had Baines and Hoglander. Even if Baines is a Miller placeholder, like that was the net front. That was the net front guys working with the power play units at practice today. Well, you know, Joshua is what, 6'3", 220 pounds. He's got, you know, 4 inches and 40 pounds on both of those guys. Like, I want to see that a lot, especially with some of the touch that Joshua showed in tight throughout last season. So would be a huge add for this team if he's able to get back, you know, next week or even the week after.
He's one of the sleeper candidates to be that fourth forward on the power play, no doubt about
it,
right?
You know, especially that's a good
if you're
take, actually,
especially
Jamie.
If you're talking net front, right? If that's where they land on, okay, that's the position where we need the guy, like Dakota Joshua, just based on his physical attributes, like he, and then the fact that he has hands, like he's the guy that makes a ton of sense there.
Hey, you know what? I love it. I hadn't actually thought about it, to be totally honest with you, but this is like, you're right. That's such a good take. You know, we think about those candidates, and I mentioned like four other names, but why not Joshua?
Yeah.
Why not Joshua at the net front? It's not like this guy's been thrown. It's not like this club has assigned a task of Dakota Joshua over the last 2 years that he didn't ace, right? Or like significantly exceed expectations on, right? Like at some point, it makes sense to just sort of keep seeing what it's possible for him to do. Because to this point, it's like, yeah, can you kill penalties? Like, yep, check. Can you play top nine? Like, yep, check. Can you score at a 20-goal rate? Like, yep. Can you play top 6 minutes in the playoffs on a tough minutes line with Elias Lindholm? Like, yep, no problem. Right? It's like at some point, right, like you got to keep challenging people that keep performing. As sort of they ramp up and move up within this league.
Challenging and rewarding them as well, right? Like, it's both.
Yeah.
It's, hey, you've aced every challenge, we're going to give you another one, but we're also rewarding you with those opportunities to show that you can keep doing it, that you can keep leveling up your game. And again, the need is definitely there. So I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves with Dakota Joshua, right? First and foremost is get him back into the lineup. That's going to be awesome for him, for the team, for the fans to see him back in games. But yeah, there's also real, obvious, tangible ways that he's going to make a big difference and contribute to the Canucks' success when he is back. All right, we'll save the Elias Pettersson conversation, I think, for the final segment here. We can get into it a little bit. But I also want to mention Kevin Lankinen and how he's performed in his three games so far for the Canucks. Obviously gets the shutout against Philly, was really, really good. His save percentage is fantastic right now. I know the public goals saved above expected numbers look really, really good for him. Got the two starts in a row, seems poised to get a run here based on Rick Tocchet's commentary. And you know, the Canucks schedule sets up well for him to play a bunch of games, right? They've got the 3 days off after tomorrow's game. They don't play back-to-back, I think, until sometime into mid-November. Not that he's going to start all of those games, right? But if he continues to perform at a high standard, he's got a chance to really cement his claim as the current clear number one goalie, at least until Thatcher Demko returns. And, you know, if this type of performance, or, you know, not that he's going to have whatever, a 950 save percentage, but if he is clearly the preferred option between him and Artur Shelovs, even when Thatcher Demko returns, I'm really fascinated to see what this team does with their goalies. I know you've said plan A might be to carry three goalies, but if Artur Shelovs ends up kind of being the clear number three of those three, I wonder if it might end up just making more sense to send him back down to Abbotsford when that moment arrives. We're a long way from that. We haven't had an update on Thatcher Demko, but Lankinen has been very, very impressive. I think it's changed their plans in the short term, going away from a 50-50 split, and I'm curious to see how it evolves the situation in the crease too.
Yeah, and you know, he was obviously good in Chicago, but there was also a lot of posts, right? Like there was an element of fortune, I think, in him keeping the clean sheet. Not in him playing well enough to give the Canucks a chance to win. He definitely did that, and that's what really matters. But I do think when you are rolling with a 970 5-on-5 save percentage, your numbers are a bit overheated, right?
Uh-huh.
Like we know how the hockey gods and the odds and percentages interact with player performance over short samples at the NHL level. But look, he's just been steady. He looks steady. The club needed some stability, I think, in net, and he's provided that. And that's what we expected, right? He'd give this team that floor. Now, to this point, he's actually given the team real ceiling, right? Like, this is a heater now, and we'll see if he can continue it in Chicago. I do expect that he'll get some run here playing as the starter. Asterisk talked specifically about it on Saturday, right? Like, specifically was like, are you at the point where you have to consider riding a hot hand? And, you know, the response was like, oh, yeah. And then he gave the answer, which you know, I don't know if I'm going to say it was an emphatic answer, but I certainly have the sense in asking Tocchet about it that, you know, club's going to give Lankanen some opportunity here. He's earned that with the way he's performed through two preseason starts and three regular season starts. Looks like he's going to get first chance to be the guy who they run with as a number one.
Yeah, again, it's the commentary from Tocchet beyond saying, yeah, I want to ride the hot hand, right? Talking about, hey, he looks big in the net. He's calm. Even when we're running around, he's calm, right? And you can tell how much that means. I think we talked about this last week, right? Especially in the early going when the team is still trying to get in its groove and find that kind of new identity, having a goalie who is in the groove, who is calm, right? Who's providing that stability and that last line of security, man, that makes a big difference for a team that's still trying things out, still trying to work out the kinks. Is it aims to build a new identity throughout the course of the season. Okay, we'll take a break here.
Sorry,
go ahead.
Just building on the goaltending, and Dom, feel free to play me off if you're so inclined. But the I do want to note, like, you know, in Edmonton, when we began to think that Demko might be getting close-ish, right, to returning from the playoff injury, for example, you know, he'd skate after practice. Like, typically for a goaltender returning from injury, you're skating after practice, but usually in a way that the media like sees that's sort of accessible in any way.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen that on this trip, right? And Rick Tocchet noted, like, gave an interesting answer, I think, when asked sort of for an update on Demko's status the other day, just sort of noting that Demko is skating occasionally. Look, I'm not trying to read too much into things or do anything like that, but skating occasionally does feel like something of a change from how the club was talking about this earlier on in the offseason. Don't know what it means precisely, but did want to sort of bring that up as a minor update in any event, as we track, you know, the huge story of Demko's availability this season.
All right, we will take a break. Final segment coming up, 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. More Canucks talk on the way here on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here live from the Kintech studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. The Bridge Street Dunbar Lumber in Ladner has moved to Progress Way in Tilbury's Industrial Park. More room, more product, more awesome. Details at DunbarLumber.com. All right, so final segment of the show here, Drancer, and I was talking about it a little bit earlier in the show. We touched on it briefly with Batch as well, but of course, look, Elias Pettersson is a huge storyline here in Vancouver in the early going of the season for a lot of obvious reasons, and it does seem like Pettersson has kind of jumped just from being a primarily local story to a bit of a national story around the NHL, right? With people kind of tuning in and chiming in on, hey, this guy's not producing. What's going on here? Going back to last year, now we can debate, is this the same thing? Is it, how much is it connected? But, you know, people picking up on those trends. And the latest example of that is Elliot Friedman on 32 Thoughts weighing in and kind of after taking on the assignment last week and saying, I'm going to do some digging into this. you know, we won't play the clip. I played it early. I'm sure you've heard it. I'm sure a lot of people have had a chance to listen to it. But basically saying, you know, one of the things he hears is that Elias Pettersson really rides the roller coaster of emotion that exists in a market like Vancouver, in a Canadian market, in a city that is very, very passionate about hockey. The highs can be very, very high. And of course, the lows can be very, very low. And Friedman saying that that could be one of the things that has been affecting Elias Pettersson's game, is that tendency to experience those highs and lows very fully, to really pay attention to what's being said, to what's being written about him. And, you know, I'm curious to get your take on it. What I had to say earlier in the show was, this is something that's, you know, this is not the first time this idea has been brought up. I think we talked about it with Don Taylor and Rick Dhaliwal in a crossover recently, and I'm certainly sympathetic. That's tough, right? Like, it's not, I'm sure it's not pleasant for players to be in that position when you're on the low part of the roller coaster. Like, I am very aware of how tough that must be. But I'll also say, if you are a Canucks fan who is concerned about what this means for the future of Elias Pettersson's career, well, Elias Pettersson's not the first player who's had to go through something like this, right? And who has had to learn how to change his relationship to the noise around him, right? Who's had to change how he interacts with what people are saying in the media. That's a process that a lot of guys have experienced, have undergone, and have come out better on the other side. So if that is a big driver of why Elias Pettersson struggled last year, why he hasn't looked quite right this year, in some ways, you can almost turn that into a positive, because this isn't like the Thatcher Demko Popliteus injury, right? Where it's like, wow, we've never even heard of that. No one's had that. We don't know what the roadmap looks like for this. This is something that people have gone through, and it's possible to change. It's possible to get better at it and make it so it's not something that is limiting your performance down the road.
Yeah, and look, I don't have any real insight into how much, you know, coverage or talking points Pettersson consumes or doesn't consume. You know, presumably, like, if he was consuming a ton of Canucks coverage talking about his performance, why is he so defensive with me when I try and hit it? You know what I mean? Like, when I'm trying to ask him questions about confidence and just sort of where he thinks his game's at. And like, he, you know, effectively shut that conversation down today. You know, you'd think if there was like one guy who's covered Pettersson's struggles fairly, it would be me, no? So I don't know how closely he must be covering it, right? Or following the chatter. Getting sort of an amorphous report of noise and criticism versus buying the headlines. You know, I don't know. Like, I don't have insight into that, to be totally honest with you, Jamie. But for sure, like, figuring out how to block that out is key in Vancouver. And we've seen Pettersson's relationship with not just the media, but with social media and how he expresses himself and how much of his life he shares. We've seen that undergo a very radical change over the course of, you know, the last 5-6 years. So, you know, perhaps there's another step in that process that helps him block out the noise. I struggle to see this as the same thing that we saw in the playoffs and down the stretch last season, because one thing that really disappeared from his game down the stretch and in the playoffs last year, well, there were two things that I always look at as an indicator. The first is drawing penalties. Pettersson's drawing penalties again. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's always a good proxy for how active, how involved, how like frequently an offensive player is getting inside their checks, is to just look at what's their penalty drawn rate. If you're drawing penalties, if Pettersson is drawing penalties, then he's putting enough stress on defensive players that they're hooking him, they're holding him, they're slashing him. He's enough of a focus that, you know, they're panicking in moments or making mistakes in moments, whether or not that's resulting in, you know, points on Pettersson's hockey cards. It's resulting in the Canucks getting man advantage opportunities. That sort of went away somewhat down the stretch and in the playoffs. It went away massively in the early part of that 2022-23 season when Pettersson was struggling, right? It's back through these first five games. Like, he is drawing penalties at a high rate again. So that, to me, is always a sign that something's different, something's modified. And I think if you're watching critically, you'll see that too, right? Like, there are chances here. There's the two chances in Tampa Bay that Jake DeBrusk set up. There was obviously the crossbar that he hit in Florida, and then he set up that Nils Höglander goal beautifully against the Philadelphia Flyers. So I do think this is a guy who's getting inside, right, creating chances at a level that he wasn't down the stretch and in the playoffs last season. That's the other one, right? Like, everything was along the wall in terms of Pedersen's touches against the Predators and against the Oilers and down the stretch sort of after the All-Star break last season. Right now, you know, he's getting touches. He's manufacturing opportunities in the middle of the ice. He's making dynamic plays in the middle of the ice. And so this to me, like, it's sort of tempting to be like, it's a 31-game stretch. It's a 50-game stretch. And it is. Like, I'm not saying it's not. But I do think there's a material difference if you're looking closely at where his game's at now versus where it was down the stretch in the playoffs last year.
Well,
and, you know, I was hoping for a little more insight from him on that today. But, you know, he doesn't want to talk about it. And I suppose that's reflective, too, of the relationship with the media, the pressure, you know, that he may be feeling from external sources at the moment. But, you know, that's kind of where I'm at with it. I there's no question that he's going to need to produce more. But I don't think you'd look at where he's at so far and say he's played poorly so much as some of the, like, conversion rate stuff, some of the high-end production stuff that has been typical of him to manage through his career isn't fully back yet.
Yeah, I think the last couple of games in particular, right, Florida and
yep.
Philly, have been the first time in this downturn where I think you could really credibly say, like, well, if he keeps playing like that, the points will come, right? Like, he's creating enough chances, involved enough that production should follow. Now, that's different than him being a superstar who's worth, you know, who's easily worth $11.6 million, right? And I think you can also look at those two games and say, are there still too many, you know, wasted touches of the puck or just not, like, soft plays with the puck where you'd like to see something more dynamic or something more assertive. I think that's fair as well. But the increase in involvement in scoring chances, either generating them himself or creating them from other for other players, dramatically different, especially in those two games, than certainly what we saw in the playoffs and the back half of last season and even through the first handful of games this year. So the positive trajectory, I think, really, for the first time in this slump, is you don't have to squint, right? You don't have to really, like, bend over backwards to see it. I think it's pretty evident in what he's doing on the ice. There's certainly still more room to do it. Like, I think, you know, when we've seen Elias Pettersson at his best, there's been almost no wasted touches with the puck in a game, right? Because that's how good he is. But again, at least you are seeing, it's not just you're almost having to, like, work really hard to see the progress. You know what I mean? The progress is just right there to see. And it's just a question of if he can keep building on it and get back to that peak version of Elias Pettersson now.
For sure. Well, and the Canucks need something closer to a peak version of Elias mm-hmm. Pettersson, especially if JT Miller is not taking draws, right? Like, they entered Saturday's game with him having taken 32 more draws than the second place Canucks center, which was Teddy Blueger, right? Like, the number was 82 versus 56, right? Like,
yep.
a massive number gap. Like, they rely heavily on Miller in the faceoff circle, and, you know, we know that Miller was dealing with something through the preseason, so you've got sort of Miller at less than 100%, right? You've got Pettersson working through, you know, what's now a prolonged stretch of games in which he hasn't been a superstar-level point producer, even if we think his game's rounding into form at the moment. And you've got Thatcher Demko without a timeline, right? So that sort of leaves, like, one of this club's four superstar level engines that are, you know, that you're sort of being like, oh man, Quinn Hughes really on top of his game at the moment. Like, Quinn Hughes just, you know, slicing and dicing his way through the neutral zone at will the way he did against the Philadelphia Flyers, right? I mean, that's meaningful, right? And it's not meaningful from a, like, big picture concern perspective so much as, you know, it creates one of those narrower roads, right, where the Canucks have less margin for error in terms of their performance, where there's, you know, fewer outs for this team to get elite results. You know, this is a star-driven league, and right now I think there's at least questions around three of four of Vancouver's main superstar players that certainly didn't exist until Demko got injured against Winnipeg last season, and that was in March, right? Like, one thing that this club had going for it is it amassed, you know, that Edmonton Oilers in the 1980s, like, goal differential, yep, right, through the first few months of the season, Jamie, was their superstar players weren't just their best players. They were some of the best players in the league. And they still, you know, have more talent than the other team that they're facing more nights than not in this league. But, you know, if you're not all firing at the top of your powers, it's a little different. It looks a little different. It stresses your depth out a little bit more. It means that what might have been a 4-1 win becomes a nervy 2-1 lead late in the game, and the other team's one bounce away from tying it up. You know, it just makes all those margins that much finer. And as we know, an accumulation of fine margins going one way or the other over the course of an NHL season can make a huge difference between being a 109-point team and a 99-point team. And if a couple other breaks go against you, right, a run of tough save percentage, a run of bad shooting luck, a la the Nashville Predators, right? You know, you can have one of those week or 2 week stretches that can put you behind the eight ball. So that's kind of where, you know, again, it's not a concern. The Canucks have stabilized their form in the early going. Yep. I think they're still working to find an identity, but certainly there's an element to which already just 10 days or so into the start of the regular season, the Canucks certainly aren't running as pure as they did last year.
Yeah, and I brought up the kind of less flashy neutral zone play driving stuff from Pedersen with Batch, right? And look, he's got to produce, right? He needs to score points, but the Canucks really need that element from Elias Pettersson when Quinn Hughes is not on the ice, right? As much as we talk about, can they do it when the other defensive pairs are on the ice, right? Not Hughes and Hronek. It's not going to necessarily come from the D-men. You need to have forwards who can really help out in that play driving regard as well. And the numbers around just like territorial control shot attempts with Quinn Hughes right now are really, really startling. They're great for Quinn Hughes, but there's maybe some cause for concern. I mean, if you just look at the total team at 5-on-5, right, Quinn Hughes, 62%, over 62% shot attempt share with him on the ice. That's 6% ahead of the next closest guy, which is his partner, Filip Hronek, right? So, like, Quinn Hughes is just even running well ahead of Filip Hronek. And then if you look at Pettersson and JT Miller individually, like Elias Pettersson, when he's on the ice with Quinn Hughes, Canucks controlling about 61% of shot attempts. When it's just Pettersson and no Hughes, that's about 40%. Very similar numbers for JT Miller, right? When he's on the ice with Quinn Hughes, 61%. When it's just Miller, no Quinn Hughes, it's all the way down to 35%, right? So neither of those two guys, who we know are capable of driving play at a really high level, are doing it consistently without Quinn Hughes. And as much as, you know, everyone wants to see Elias Pettersson have, you know, a 5-point night, start to put the puck in the net consistently, if he can first and foremost just kind of stabilize that element, take care of that part of the game, get the Canucks spending more time in the other team's zone when he's out there, like, that's something this team desperately, desperately needs in the early going, because Quinn Hughes is doing his part and he has been exceptional at it. But the other guys who are really capable of it, they're not doing it yet.
For sure. Look, the logic too of what the Canucks did, right? The deliberate, holistic way that they played and adapted their game to maximize their strengths kind of required Miller and Hughes get sicked on tough competition, right? And then Pettersson helps to drive play and shelter the second and third pairs against secondary comp.
Yep.
Right? Like that was part of the like matchup intelligence of how Tocchet approached things with the roster last season. If that logic is undermined, right? And if that logic is undermined with both Miller and with Pettersson, right? That's how you get to a point where too much is asked of Quinn,
mm-hmm,
right? Like that's where you get to a point where you're being, you know, significantly outshot in those non-Hughes minutes, the way the Canucks were in the first four games and the way they weren't in Philadelphia, which is why that win seemed so promising. From my perspective. So, you know, again, it's just one of those things where it, you know, sort of somewhat risks, like it's a little bit of instability that the club has taken on versus their profile last season. And, you know, I do think it makes for more complicated choices and perhaps finer margins in some of these games, which might honestly be part of what we've seen occur, over these five Canucks games so far?
You asked Batch about this. So just in the final few minutes, I'll flip it around to you. Is Eric Brandstrom a thing? Is Eric Brandstrom a real thing for the Canucks? Could he be a real thing for the Canucks?
Well, and I asked it vaguely because I like it as a Rorschach question. Like,
it reminds me of the old David Letterman bit, right? Is this anything?
Is this anything? Well, and so what would a thing be for you?
It's tough because I struggle to see him replacing Derek Forbort in the lineup when Derek Forbort is healthy. So, like, does clear-cut seventh defenseman, does that qualify as a thing?
I think a thing is whatever you want it to be, buddy.
Because that's probably as far as I'm willing to go right now.
So let me give you an example of something that would be a thing that I think would help the Canucks a lot. Because I think Mark Friedman last year, right? Canucks acquire him, ironically, in Philadelphia, almost exactly a year ago today. And, you know, he gets into the lineup for the first time, like, not in their next game against Tampa, but the game after against the Florida Panthers, and then forms this second pair with Ian Cole that only lasts a month. By mid-November, it's done, and Friedman spends the rest of the year as sort of more of a depth contributor for the team, right? But the Canucks amass something like an 8-1-1 record, right? Well, he was in the lineup. Mm-hmm. Playing with Ian Cole. He helped stabilize a defensive group that, you know, even earlier on in the season, like, do you remember how Juulsen and Akito Hirose struggled in that second game against the Edmonton Oilers? And then how much Juulsen struggled against the Flyers in that third game of the year, right? Like, there was just, Juulsen needed some work before he was capable of doing what he was able to do for this team over the latter 50 games of the season. But Friedman was able to come in and give the club a boost in relatively difficult deployment, playing a defensive-minded role on a pair with Ian Cole. And it gave the Canucks, the space to have the hot start that they did, and B, I think the space to make the Zadorov deal, figure out some other things on defense, work with Noah Juulsen internally, et cetera, et cetera. Like, that's a thing. That's a thing, and it provided immense value to this hockey club last season, even if Friedman ends up being waived at the tail end of training camp this year, even if he only ends up playing an additional 12 games over the balance of the campaign, the way Friedman did. So even if Brandstrom can hit that level and just like give this team a short-term puck moving boost, as they sort of get through this early phase of the season, see where Demko is, see where their goaltending gets to, let Pettersson work through, you know, an early season cold streak, let DeBrusk work through an early season cold streak, hopefully give Miller enough time, you know, to get back to 100% or close to it, at least to the level that he's driving play the way he usually does again. And boom, like if he can give them some puck moving support through, you know, even a 4 or 5 week stretch where he's a lineup regular, that's successful for this team and gives them the space to get to full strength. To me, that's a thing. And that to me is a level that he totally could be at. Now, he'll have to sustain that level for an awfully long time beyond that for him to be a thing, from the perspective of being like a long-term fit on the third pair, right? But we don't have to sort of cross that bridge. His first two games have been promising enough that I think he has a chance to buy this team some time while stabilizing some of their secondary puck moving in a bottom pair role. I think he's been to that level through two games. Will be fascinating to see if he can keep it up.
If that's the bar, then 100%. He can be a thing for sure. If we start to go beyond that, where he's like a regular first choice to be in on the blue line when everyone's healthy,
to see it for a lot longer.
That is a much different conversation.
Before I'm having that conversation.
But guy they can plug into the lineup, if he clears that bar, that's something they didn't have a couple of weeks ago, right, with his profile. So even that could be a significant development for the team. We'll wrap up there. Canucks game day tomorrow. They're taking on the Chicago Blackhawks, final game of their road trip. Drancer will be on the scene, so we'll have full game day coverage tomorrow here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.